From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As early as today, House Oversight Committee Chair Elijah Cummings could subpoena the former head of White House security clearances after a career White House employee blew the whistle on what she said were dozens of Trump administration officials receiving clearances despite what she called disqualifying issues. At a stormy committee meeting this morning, Cummings expressed concerns that national security could be compromised.
Over and over again, I hear these comments about, oh, they're just trying to embarrass the president. No, that is not true. What we're trying to do is protect our secrets. We're trying to make sure we have a process that works.
Reporter Tim Mack covers national security for NPR. He joins us now. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And, you know, we heard some of these reports, you know, filtering out in news reports about the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Now we have this whistleblower. Chairman Cummings calls this a million times worse than Hillary Clinton's emails. But he also acknowledges the president has the legal right to grant clearances. Tell us more about that.
Well, the clearance process is basically an authority that emanates from the power of the president to make documents secret or not secret, public or private, based on national security interests. So the president has wide latitude in order to figure out who gets a security clearance, who doesn't get a security clearance. Now, with that said, Democrats are saying, even though he has this authority, nothing illegal has yet been suggested here. Even though he has this authority, is it correct? Is it right? Is it proper for some individuals who otherwise wouldn't make it through a security clearance process to be given a security clearance? And are there some sort of risks that come with that?
Well, and they usually have to go through the personnel security office where this whistleblower, Tricia Newbold, has been there for several administrations. She says she was retaliated against. Her then boss, Carl Klein, overrode recommendations, didn't take care of sensitive material, you know, stopped performing some checks, or his office did. And this gets ugly, Tim. She has a form of dwarfism. This is Tricia Newbold, the whistleblower. She filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that he actually moved files out of her reach. So just tell us a little bit more about what she is saying that was so compelling that she became a whistleblower.
So there are several parts to this, right? So first, she expressed concerns that career staffers deny security clearances for 25 Trump administration officials, but later these suggestions were overturned without what she believes was proper documentation or analysis. She expressed this internally. She expressed it to her supervisor and her superiors. She didn't feel that much was done to address this core problem. And after raising these issues, she said that she felt that she was acted out on, that they retaliated against her in ways to humiliate her, from a two-week unpaid suspension to the situation you mentioned where her boss allegedly moved files that she needed for work out of her out of the places that she could reach it. You mentioned that she had a rare form of dwarfism.
Yeah. Well, Democrats say she came forward and gave them a private interview, and that sparked a lot of debate on the committee this morning. Here's an exchange between Ranking Member Jim Jordan and Chairman Cummings.
I've been on this committee 10 years. I've never seen anything like this.
Oh, please.
Never seen anything like this. I haven't.
Yeah, you've done it.
Okay, so how are Republicans pushing back?
Well, they say that Cummings and Democrats on the committee are cherry-picking excerpts from Ms. Newbold's testimony. They say that they weren't given enough time to properly prepare for that interview and that this whole thing is part of a Democratic effort to manufacture a scandal about the White House not properly conducting itself with regards to national security. Republicans say this is a unilateral and partisan investigation.
Yeah, well, White House advisor Jared Kushner is suspected to be one of the two dozen or so Trump officials thought to have gotten this clearance. He says this is not true. I've been accused of a lot of things, including with Russia, not true. But former Chief of Staff John Kelly wrote a memo saying he was forced to give him clearance.
Well, that's an interesting part of this whole investigation. And it's an investigation that has been going on not just in this Congress, not just in the last few months, but over the last couple of years. And it's going to be interesting to see where the investigation goes from here.
We will watch with you. Tim Mack covers national security for NPR. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, today, voters in Chicago are at the polls again for a runoff in the mayor's race. And whatever they decide, history will be made as the city elects its first black female mayor, either Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle or former federal prosecutor Lori Lightfoot. The city's mayoral race started out with 14 candidates, and that was narrowed to the top two finishers in February. Joining us now is WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos in Chicago. Dan, let's talk about the two candidates. First, if Lori Lightfoot wins, Chicago would be the largest U.S. city ever to elect an openly gay mayor. Here's Lori Lightfoot.
So I need you from now until the polls close on Tuesday night. Do not rest. Keep your foot on the gas.
Tell us more about Lori Lightfoot.
Well, Lori Lightfoot is someone who's running for office for the first time in her 56 years. And she is someone that has been around, though. She worked under the mayor who's retiring, Rahm Emanuel. She worked under the previous mayor, Richard M. Daley. And she is someone who has been involved in police reform issues and issues of police accountability, which have been really big issues here in Chicago as elsewhere. But particularly since a few years ago, they released a video of an officer who fired 16 shots into a 17-year-old African-American teen named Laquan McDonald.
Right, right. And we've heard a lot about that. The other option today is Tony Preckwinkle, who is the Cook County Board President. Here she is.
I've led a life of public service, and I'm proud of it. And I think it's prepared me uniquely for the job in front of us.
Tell us more about Tony Preckwinkle.
Tony Preckwinkle is someone who, unlike Lori Lightfoot, has been an elected official here for a very long time, a very familiar face to people in Chicago. She was the member of the city council representing the part of town where Barack Obama lived for two decades. And then for the past 8 years, she's been the president of the board of Cook County, which is the county that includes Chicago. On top of all that, she is also the leader of the Cook County Democratic Party. So she's kind of what we call the boss here in Chicago.
So she is more part of the machine, I guess you would say.
Well, that's certainly how Lori Lightfoot has sought to paint Tony Preckwinkle. But Tony Preckwinkle has countered that she has a long track record of fighting against the powers that be on behalf of progressive causes like affordable housing, criminal justice reform, and that she's the one that has a lot of experience trying to painstakingly enact change in a city that's has a lot of problems.
We were in Chicago, Dan, covering the mayor's race back in February and heard about a lot of issues, including corruption. One of the city's most powerful aldermen was charged a few months back. We also heard a lot of people talking about how the current mayor, Rahm Emanuel, had focused too much attention on the city's downtown, perhaps at the expense of some of the poorer neighborhoods of Chicago. What would you say are the issues that most voters are concerned about as they head to the polls today?
I think there is a lot of concern about corruption. We've had an awful lot of corruption scandals in Chicago over the years, but I don't think we've ever quite had a situation quite like this where you have a corruption scandal of this magnitude falling so shortly before the election. And then on top of it, Tony Preckwinkle is referenced, not by name, but they talk about how some of this corruption allegedly benefited her campaign fund that this Alderman Burke, who was indicted recently or is about to be indicted, actually. So I think corruption is first and foremost on the minds of many, but also, you know, the gap between the glittering downtown that you saw and some of the neighborhoods that you probably also visited. There's a vast gap. And in fact, the reporting that we've done here shows that income inequality has grown tremendously in Chicago in recent decades, as in some other parts of the country.
I remember back on the first election day in February, there were a lot of people who didn't even want to head to the polls that day. There were 14 candidates to pick from. What about today? What are you expecting in terms of turnout?
I think it's not going to be very high. You know, historically, we've had these elections at a time of year when the weather is still bad in Chicago to discourage turnout. And the theory being that the lower the turnout is, the more the political machine can sort of control the outcome. And this time around, we had a lot of different choices, and yet there was still a lot of apathy. I think people were unimpressed with many of the choices. Neither of these two candidates that made the runoff even approached 20% in that first round. But all the polls are indicating that Lori Lightfoot, with her message of change, I think is resonating a little bit with voters that are in a very ugly anti-incumbent mood.
And either way, as we said, it'll be historic because it'll be the first black female mayor and actually the first black mayor in decades in Chicago. Do people feel that history today?
Oh, absolutely. I think when you have a city like Chicago where no racial group comes anywhere near being a majority, it's roughly a third Hispanic, a third black, and a third white, you have a tendency for the power over in the course of the history of the city to be, like I said, dictated by the machine, and usually a white guy is on the fifth floor of City Hall, which is where the mayor's office is. So this will be certainly the second woman mayor in the history of the city, the third black mayor in the history, and possibly the first openly gay mayor.
That is WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos joining us from Chicago as voters head to the polls for the runoff in the mayor's race today. Dan, thank you.
My pleasure.
There have been some terrible headlines recently. Within 10 days, two student survivors of last year's Parkland, Florida school shooting took their lives. Then Jeremy Richmond, the father of a 6-year-old murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary, took his life. Terrible. As Frank DeAngelis knows, Frank was the principal at Colorado's Columbine High on April 20th, 1999, when two students wounded more than 20 and slaughtered 13, including Coach Dave Sanders. Though not the first school shooting in the U.S. at the time, it was the worst at the time and the first to play out largely on live TV, because back then responders were prevented from going into a school until a SWAT team came. And that took almost an hour, hours more for an all clear. So police and Frank and the country watched helplessly as school fire alarms wailed and at least one shot student jumped out a window. Before that, Principal DeAngelis came face to face with one of the shooters, stayed on 15 years after the shooting to fulfill a pledge to see every kid in the system in 1999 graduate. His first memoir is out. It's titled They Call Me Mr. D. Today, the first of our two-part conversation with Frank DeAngelis, and a warning. This topic is often tender. We started by asking about the recent suicides. Well, you have become now part of, as you say, a terrible club that goes to comfort other schools. You'd been to both Marjory Stoneman Douglas and Sandy Hook. I can't imagine what you were thinking when you heard this news.
It was difficult when I heard about the two students. It took me back. I remember exactly 6 months and 2 days after our tragedy, one of our students who was critically injured, Anne Marie Hallcoulter's mom, took her own life.
Yep.
It was the following May, one of our students who was in the classroom with Dave Sanders took his own life, Greg Barnes. And then when I heard about Jeremy, it really hit hard because the summer after Sandy Hook, he came out to Colorado. Just a wonderful man, and he was, you know, talking about healing, and he was talking about all the work he was doing with brain research. And so when it came across the wire that, you know, he had taken his own life, it hit pretty hard.
Well, I'm wondering if it also frightens you. I mean, you mentioned Carla Hochhalter. Her daughter, Anne Marie, was paralyzed. We've spoken with Anne Marie. Her mother walked into a pawn shop, asked for a gun, and shot herself. And then Greg Barnes, he was with your friend Dave Sanders. They were trying to stop him from bleeding. Greg was showing Dave pictures from his wallet of his kids, trying to keep him going. I mean, you wonder, how can someone survive that? He hanged himself. I mean, you know, your heart must break all over again.
Well, it really does. And one of the things that we really noticed after Columbine with so many of our students is they didn't want to share their experiences. And even now, and I'll always call them my kids, mm-hmm. but now they're 38 years old. And some of those parents came and said, Frank, we wish we would have listened to you and been a little more persistent in getting our kids into mental health checks, because they told us we're fine, we don't need to talk to anyone. And now, you know, 20 years later, some of them are struggling.
Yeah. Well, we talked with Amy Over, who was one of the students, and then as a mother was taking her child to her first day of school and completely collapsed. They thought she was having a heart attack, delivering her child to a school.
Yeah. some parents came up to me and said, Frank, even though we didn't lose our students, even though they did not die, we have lost our students. Mm. And so you hear stories like Amy. There was a young lady, Michelle Romero Wheeler, came into my office in 2012 and just crying uncontrollably. And I said, what is going on, Michelle? She said, today, my little girl is getting ready to walk her up to the door at kindergarten, and she held her hand, and then all of a sudden, the little girl starts walking. She runs up there and grabs her and clenches her to her chest, and everyone's coming up saying, you are right, you are right. And she said, I was struggling, and my little girl saying, Mommy, Mommy, you're hurting me. And all I could think about, if I allowed her to walk in that building, there a chance she may not come home. Yeah. So
the aftermath is, and it continues to this day. I mean, Anne Marie, again, paralyzed by a bullet, talks about how she has to have friends text her if there's another shooting because she can't be caught off guard. Same thing with Craig Scott, whose beautiful sister Rachel was killed. He says he can't watch TV news reports of the Las Vegas shooting, for instance, can't hear shots. Everything triggers them. By the way, do you have the triggers too?
I do. If a balloon pops, I mean, I'll start crying. I was helping one night at parent-teacher conferences, and all of a sudden, a car backfired. And luckily, the police officer was a friend of mine, and he knew exactly what I was going through because I, you know, bent over and start shaking. You know, yesterday I had a chance to talk to Craig Scott and his mom, Beth. We were together, and he was just sharing these stories. And for me, for example, last year when the Parkland shooting happened on February 14th, I was getting off a plane, and I turned my phone back on, and when I start getting texts saying, you're in my thoughts and prayers, if you need anything, let me know. Well, within 5 minutes, I can guarantee my phone's going to start ringing. So you are re-traumatized.
Well, and what did Craig say to you?
Beth Nemo, Rachel's mom, was sharing her story. She got a phone call from Craig. Craig saying, I haven't seen my sister. And then Beth talks about going down to the elementary school.
This is the day of the Columbine shooting when parents were waiting for their kids, right?
Right. And as the evening went on, there were fewer people. People were saying, Frank, there's no more buses, which were transporting the kids. That's when the grief counselor said, Frank, you need to take those parents and we need to go tell them. In hearing that yesterday, and it's going to be almost 20 years, it took me back to that evening, and I started crying. I started just getting shivers and almost nauseam. It just took me back. And then when Craig was telling me the story of him being in the library and two of his, you know, died on top of him, it just took me back to that day, even though it's 20 years moved past.
Yeah. Well, you're very honest about your own PTSD and your need for therapy, even though there were people in the school district that told you, don't do that.
And there is a stigmatism, and people still feel that if you seek mental health or counseling, that's a sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. And there were some people that advised me, if you do, you better not tell anyone because they may seem you're deemed unfit for duty. Mm-hmm. A good friend of mine, my mom actually worked for him, John Fisher, and he was a Vietnam veteran. And he said, Frank, you're going to be pulled in so many different directions, and everyone needs you. But if you don't help yourself, you can't help anyone else. And that's a message I share when I go to Parkland and Santa Fe and Sandy Hook. But another key component, I'm a cradle Catholic, and, you know, right after the event, I was questioning my faith. And it was a couple of days later, Father Ken Leone, who was the pastor over at St. Francis Cabrini, where I had been a member for 20 years, he said, Frank, you need to come down to the church. I said, Father, I just can't. I'm not in a good place. He said, you need to come down. And when I walked into the church, there was over 1,200 people, and many were students because they were part of the youth group. And he called me up on the altar, and we prayed. But the thing that he whispered in my ear was, Frank, you should have died, but God's got a plan for you.
Yeah. Well, the kids supported you, the teachers supported you, but there were also a lot of lawsuits. People wanted to blame you. You blamed yourself. But soon you were also defending against reports about the shooters and the climate at the school. We don't name shooters.
Right.
But the storyline, the narrative was that they were bullied by a jock culture in the school. David Cullen, who's a journalist who spent 10 years researching this for his book Columbine, he said the initial reporting was wrong. These were not bullied outsiders. These were deeply disturbed, some said psychotic young people. And that was revealed in the tapes that they made, now destroyed, which you saw. How enraging was it to have your school misrepresented that way?
It was so frustrating because I promised to protect our kids from some of the information that was being passed out, but there were also pending lawsuits. So many times I couldn't say, and those initial reports, unfortunately, are still, the first narratives are still being believed 20 years
later.
Sure,
if you Google, you will see that the two shooters were members of this trench coat mafia. Not true, they were wearing trench coats to hide their guns. Yet you do tell us things that are chilling. I mean, if the parents had only, you know, maybe gone into their bedrooms, gone into their basements, they would have found pipe bombs and this arsenal. If one of the fathers had only thought when he got a call from a gun store clerk saying, your order of ammunition is here, he said, oh, I didn't order that. Well, wait a minute, who ordered that? It was his son who ordered that. You know, those are chilling clues that were overlooked. But meantime, I do want to stay with what you think. You know, we've learned so much. First responders, the mandate is go right in as soon as you get to a shooting to go after the shooter. Don't wait, as they so sadly did in Columbine. I mean, maybe your friend Dave Sanders wouldn't have bled to death. And have blueprints of the school so that first responders can know exactly where rooms are. What else?
And one of the things I need to say is the police, they got unjustly criticized. I was on the street, and I was the one drawing blueprints, and I was the one that they were going to put a bulletproof vest on to go disarm the fire alarm. But many of those police officers, they were angry because they were being told that they had to stay outside, and it was the protocol. And as a matter of fact, we had a school resource officer outside exchanging gunfire. And that's one of the most frustrating things for the people who were trapped in the building, because they were looking outside at the window. And there must have been 500 responding officers, but no one was coming into the building until the SWAT team. Yeah.
That's Frank DeAngelis, principal of Columbine High School in Colorado, on April 20th, 1999, during the mass shooting there. His new first memoir is They Call Me Mr. D. Tomorrow, his memories.
I encountered the gunman, and through counseling, I learned why I continued to go towards that gunman, because I had about 25 girls that were coming out of the locker room to go to a physical education class.
How he saved those girls, tomorrow, here and now. And let's take up China's announcement that it is banning fentanyl, the powerful opioid responsible for a record number of overdose deaths in the U.S. The Chinese do regulate legal production, but manufacturers get around that, and so officials are now pledging a total ban. And that decision is a victory for President Trump, who has been blasting China. This could also be a concession from China in the ongoing trade negotiations. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, as you know, the Chinese don't agree with the president that they're causing the crisis here in the U.S. They blame it on a culture of addiction. But this illicit fentanyl, it goes from China to Mexico before coming into the U.S., or it's mailed in, killed more than 28,000 people in 2017. Why is China agreeing to ban it now?
Yeah, so China is just incorrect in the fact that most overdose deaths in the U.S. are from opioids. Most of those opioids are fentanyl. Most of that fentanyl comes from China. It could come from somewhere else, but for the moment it comes from China. However, China's sort of been backed into a corner here, particularly with the trade negotiations. So they're looking for areas they can do something about, and in China they can. What they do is they already regulate a lot of types of fentanyl, but the laws are written for drugs in China, unlike the United States, where somebody can make a molecular change to a drug that'll have the same effect but doesn't fall under the law. So now they are broadening that out to make all types of fentanyl a controlled substance that regular people can't buy unless you have some very special reason to buy it.
Well, their announcement came after a promise Xi Jinping made to President Trump at the G20 summit in Buenos Aires last year. Two questions. Can you really ban fentanyl, because we understand some of the parts of fentanyl can be sent here to be mixed? And how does this tie into trade negotiations?
Well, so you can. You know, China, it's hard. It's hard to ban it because you'd have to have inspectors. So enforcement of all sorts in drugs depend on how strong your enforcement can be and how much money you're prepared to put into it. Can you figure out the components of fentanyl and ban those too? It's difficult because components go into other things. So in the same way that when you go into drugstores in some places in the United States, you can't buy antihistamines over the counter. You have to get it from a pharmacist because you might be making something out of it.
Right.
Donald Trump, despite people who criticize him on a lot of fronts, he has actually been fairly committed to this. It does seem important to him to try and deal with the opioid crisis and set the federal government to doing some things about this. So he did want Xi Jinping to address this. And Xi at the time, I think, thought that they'd be doing better in their trade negotiations. So in a sign that either it's a sign of goodwill that they want these trade negotiations to continue, or in a sign of, all right, we'll give something up, this looks like why the Chinese are doing this, because they, as you said, they haven't even acknowledged that they're the source of the problem, let alone decided to do anything about it until today.
Huh. And so given that, where do you think these negotiations stand?
Well, they were hashing out an agreement last week in Beijing. It's going to continue this week in Washington on Thursday and Friday. It is unclear. The president has dropped some hints that things are going well, which is why we've seen a bit of a market surge earlier this week. But it is not clear. It is complicated, and we don't know where this is going to end.
Oh, okay. Well, we will watch. And in the few seconds we have, don't you need some fentanyl? Isn't it? Doesn't it have legal?
It does have legal. Yes, it's very much more powerful than morphine. But for end of life patients, and particularly cancer patients, it is a drug that does keep them out of pain.
Okay, Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The Justice Department appears likely to miss today's deadline to hand over the nearly 400-page Mueller report to the House Judiciary Committee, which means the committee will likely vote to subpoena the report tomorrow. The Attorney General, William Barr, released a 4-page summary of the report a little over a week ago and concluded that there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians during the 2016 election, and that Trump did not obstruct justice, in part because, Barr said, there was no underlying crime. Republicans backed Barr's summary. Here is Senator Rand Paul on Fox News.
I think that you can't obstruct justice when there wasn't a crime. How do you cover up for a crime that didn't occur? So if President Trump and nobody in his campaign colluded with Russia, which was the accusation, if they didn't do that, how can they be covering up for something they didn't do?
Democrats were suspicious of the accuracy of Barr's conclusion on obstruction. Here is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Congressman Gerald Nadler.
Attorney General Barr, who auditioned for his role with an open memorandum suggesting that the obstruction investigation was unconscionable and that a president and that it was almost impossible for any president to commit obstruction of justice since he is the head of the executive branch, made a decision about that evidence in under 48 hours. His conclusions raise more questions than the answer, given the fact that Mueller uncovered evidence that, in his own words, does not exonerate the president.
So a legal disagreement there. Let's turn to Noah Feldman, a Harvard Law professor. He joins us on Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to go through a couple of legal arguments in William Barr's letter first. In making the determination that the president did not obstruct justice, he noted that the special counsel recognized that the evidence does not establish that the president was involved in an underlying crime and that the absence of such evidence bears upon the president's intent with respect to obstruction. Is that right, that you have to commit an underlying crime in order to obstruct justice?
You don't have to commit an underlying crime to obstruct justice. I could be accused of something I didn't do, and then I could obstruct justice to try to avoid being caught for some third thing. However, to be fair to the Attorney General, he didn't say that that was a necessary precondition. What he said is that it bears upon it, and that is, in fact, true. If you're trying in a real-world situation to prove that someone is guilty of obstruction of justice, you need to show that they intended to obstruct it. And that's especially true in the context of the president and his firing of James Comey. The fact that there was, in fact, according to the Mueller report, no collusion to hide bears on the question of proving what Trump's intent was when he fired Comey. And in that sense, Barr is correct.
So do you think that Barr made the right call?
I think Barr made an inevitable call. The true question here is, why did Mueller say that there was not sufficient evidence for him to say definitively that Trump committed obstruction of justice? And presumably the reason is we can't see inside of Trump's head to determine what his true intent was when he fired Comey, and there are no tapes. Consequently, the reality is that no prosecutor could go forward with a charge against Trump under these circumstances, even if he weren't the president. So it was inevitable, once Mueller said that he was not going to weigh in on the question one way or the other, that ultimately, Barr would say that no prosecution should go forward. I think it was inevitable.
One of the names that has come up in this discussion is Martha Stewart, who, of course, was acquitted of the underlying crime in her insider trading case, but convicted of obstructing justice.
it's not impossible to prove that someone has obstructed justice. For example, if you have proof that they lied to prosecutors, that's obstruction of justice. On the other hand, in the case of Donald Trump, there was no definitive proof that he had obstructed justice. Instead, what we have is the contested fact that he fired Comey. If you think that you could prove that he did so in order to cover up Russian collusion, that was obstruction. If you can't prove that, then you wouldn't go forward on an obstruction charge. So that's why it's different than the Martha Stewart situation.
Do you think the president still faces the possibility of a charge of obstructing justice?
No, I don't think that even after he leaves office, any subsequent attorney general would be able to authorize a criminal charge. Now that this attorney general has said that in his determination there was not sufficient evidence to charge for obstruction, and also importantly, given that Mueller himself in his report said that he couldn't say definitively that one should go forward against the president. I think, again, the key decision here was Mueller's decision not to say in his report, I think the president is guilty of obstruction. And Barr's action is really just an inevitable confirmation that follows on the Mueller determination.
Okay. The second thing I want to ask you about is this idea that's been floating around that the president cannot be indicted. And in fact, Barr cited in his letter, quote, the constitutional considerations that surround the indictment and criminal prosecution of a sitting president. And he cites a 2000 memo from Randolph Moss, who is an assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel, that says the indictment or criminal prosecution of a sitting president would unconstitutionally undermine the capacity of the executive branch to perform its constitutionally assigned functions. Is that settled then, or do you think there's debate about whether a sitting president can be indicted?
There's debate among legal thinkers as to this question. Historically, the Office of Legal Counsel and the Department of Justice, which indirectly works for the president, has consistently held, going all the way back to Watergate, that the president himself cannot be indicted while he's in office. However, other actors, including people who wrote memos for various special counsels and independent counsels, have taken the opposite view and said that the president could be indicted. The crucial point is that because the Department of Justice is the very entity that charges people under the U.S. system for federal crimes, so long as the Department of Justice has a policy in place that it won't prosecute the president, then de facto, until or unless that were to change, no sitting president will be indicted. So that's why, in practice, the side that believes that he can't be indicted makes the indictment decision. In theory, that might be the wrong legal position.
But couldn't the Department of Justice just change its position? This is based, as we said, on just a memo from somebody who most people have probably never heard of, although now he's a federal judge, Randolph Moss. But, you know.
No, I think you got to take a step back. The Office of Legal Counsel is the office within the Department of Justice that is charged under all circumstances with determining the legality and constitutionality of executive action. The memo is a well-thought-out, well-argued, lengthy document. It's possible to disagree with it, and I do disagree with it on certain points. But it's not some fly-by-night thing. In order for the Department of Justice to change its policy, there would have to be a new memo by a new Office of Legal Counsel official that refuted or disagreed with the reasoning there. So, yes, in principle, that policy can change, but there's a procedure whereby it would change.
So what is it that you disagree with about that conclusion?
I understand that there are very strong practical reasons to avoid indicting a sitting president, after all, who would run the country. I also understand that there's a constitutional argument that says that the president himself is the head of the executive branch. However, if there were circumstances where the public could see clearly that the president was clearly guilty of a felony and Congress refused to impeach the president so that we had a president who was very clearly in violation of the clear federal law but was still governing and was still in theory the nation's chief law enforcement officer, that would look, to my mind, too much like the president was above the law. And under those very specific circumstances, I think there is room to say that in order to preserve our system from the preposterousness of a clear felon running the country, that it would be appropriate and constitutionally permissible for the president to be indicted. Those are unusual circumstances, but they could arise.
What do you say to the many Americans who look now at the situation following the Mueller report and the Barr letter about the Mueller report? Who say that it does seem like the president is above the law if he has done some things that many people believe to be illegal and he's been cleared?
I would say very clearly that if you trusted that Bob Mueller's team would get to the bottom of this investigation, and I trusted that, and as indeed most liberals and Democrats that I know trusted, they went through a process and they reached the conclusion that they could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the president committed crimes. That, to me, is something that must be taken very seriously. I know lots of the people on the Mueller team. They're extraordinarily impressive people. They gave up years of their lives, years of income in many cases, to go work on this case. They did that for one reason. They wanted to get to the bottom of the issues, and I think many of them hoped that they would be able to bring down the president. And they didn't. That's not because of some conspiracy. It's because they tried, and legitimately, under the rules and under the law, after a full investigation of a couple of years, they did not see that the evidence was there. I respect that judgment the same way I would have respected it if Mueller had come back and said the president was guilty of a felony.
One more question, Noah Feldman. Are you curious as to what's in the Mueller report? Are you going to read it when it is released, even if it's in redacted form?
I'll read it cover to cover, and if there are redactions, I'll try to hold them up to the light and read through those, too.
Okay.
Can't wait to find out.
That is Noah Feldman, a law professor at Harvard University. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
There's a schooling option that some parents and teachers say is terrific for young African-American kids. It's called African-centered learning, with curriculum that focuses on the experiences and accomplishments of blacks. Supporters began opening schools in the U.S. in the late 1960s. At its height, there were at least 60 African-centered schools, mostly in larger cities. By the 1990s, Detroit had more African-centered schools than anywhere else in the country. But in the past two decades, more than a dozen of those schools have closed. Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman reports on what that loss means for some of the city's kids.
So, keep in mind that question. Okay?
African proverbs and pictures of Harriet Tubman line the hallways at Paul Robeson Malcolm X Academy in Detroit. Waliyah Dawson is teaching a sixth grade class about post-World War II America. The lesson focuses on how black people were treated at the time.
But at the same time, you have people like Dr. King who stepped up and said...
This is one of Detroit's few remaining schools that uses an African-centered curriculum.
We pretty much take pieces of our African-American heritage or culture and try to infuse it into the curriculum.
In other words, the school teaches from the perspective of African descendants rather than Europeans. While most schools teach kids about former U.S. presidents and the contributions from European immigrants, African-centered schools focus on the experience of slaves and the accomplishments of black people.
It's making the child the center of their education, letting them know that where they came from and how things came to be the way they are right now.
Dawson's been teaching for 25 years. Her students know her as Mama Waliyah. The Swahili titles of Mama for female teachers and Baba for male teachers are staples of African-centered schools. During the 1990s, Detroit had 17 of these schools. But in 1999, the state took control of the district, and African-centered schools were the casualties of many rounds of closures and district restructurings. With an emphasis on standardized testing to determine school funding, few of these schools had the test scores to stay open. The principal at Paul Robeson Malcolm X estimates that more than 8,500 seats vanished from African-centered classrooms in Detroit in the past two decades. Now only three of these schools remain in the city, and advocates say Detroit's black children are the ones who lost the most.
Because we live in a world, in an environment, in a society that's Eurocentric.
This is Jamon Jordan. He taught at the Inseroma Institute for 9 years. The Detroit African-centered K-8 school closed in 2012. He thinks a Eurocentric society is inherently white supremacist.
It upholds the idea that the thinking of whites, the accomplishments of whites, and even the lives of whites is more important than the thinking, the accomplishments, and the lives of other people, people of color, including African people.
Jordan argues African-centered education prepares black students to battle white supremacy, and he says it's best to begin that battle early.
A lot of the things that I learned in school definitely molded me into a person that I am today that I feel like has a more informed view about the world.
Darius Glenn is 24. He's a poet and musician. Glenn attended one of Detroit's African-centered schools that's now closed.
Reading about Claude McKay in fifth grade and reciting his poem got me into spoken word.
Glenn says he started out in traditional public schools, but he wasn't as engaged in learning about people who not only didn't look like him, but owned people who looked like him. Glenn transferred to an African-centered school in fifth grade, and he says it engaged him in ways he hadn't experienced before.
Like I said, learning about a lot of black folks in history, it definitely can give you a sense of pride, a sense of, you know what I mean, belonging.
That's something Ebony West was looking for. West grew up in Houston, and she says she never felt completely at ease in school. She always felt like she had to explain things to her white friends about her hair or her skin or her diet. But her brothers came up in Detroit, where they attended African-centered schools, and she saw a better option, one she wanted for her own kids.
You can't shield kids from the world and from racism and otherness and, you know, misunderstandings, hurt feelings, all of those things. You can't shield them from that, but you can incubate them. You can protect them. You can let them develop a really solid sense of self before you let the rest of those things in.
So in 1999, she enrolled her oldest daughter at an African-centered school, and then her son, to help them develop a solid sense of who they were and a pride in who they were before the world could get to them.
There's something that really can break your spirit, you know, and damage you, actually, in a way that's, I feel like, irreparable.
Those schools where she sent her older kids are closed now, but Wes says they were a place where her kids felt loved, comfortable, and safe. And she says that's the best environment for anyone to learn in. For Here and Now, I'm Bryce Huffman.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.